I'm ready.
Nice. And then also, are you recording like on your computer?
Yeah, I started recording just in case. Like, I know you didn't tell me to press record, but I was like, I should probably.
No, that's good instinct.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. You never know. So I just like literally started pressing record as soon as I got accepted into the Zoom meeting.
It's the energy we're about.
Mm-hmm. Everything is content. Hashtag everything is content.
Yeah, documentation, content. It's all very important for us creators.
Fueled by lore on a Tuesday, Wednesday. It's so odd finding the light of Thursday, Friday. Settle in the ashes. It's our way to talk a lot here. I'm
trying to get better at like taking pictures when I go and do things because I've been the worst at that. And then
everything
it's like,
that happens is a mystery.
Yes. It's like, I don't remember what I did last week. What's going on?
And then, like, your mom or someone asks you, so, what have you been up to? Mom, I've been working on my creative life. Okay, what have you been doing? And then you don't have any pictures, and you don't have any, like, proof to tell anyone.
But I promise it's been happening.
Yeah, right? I mean, people never believe. Some people don't believe, like, us creative people are actually, like, working very, very hard.
Constantly.
Yeah, like, literally, like, night and day, staying up. Literally just doing our best. People don't believe us. That's why documentation is very, very important in our line of work. It's very, very important.
It's crazy how important it is sometimes though, because it's like, I can't even just sit down to like freely sketch without thinking like, oh, I should be recording this. Oh, I should be like, you know, scanning the process and whatever, just, you know, to have content.
Exactly.
Just to prove to people that like art happens. You know?
Yeah, right. It's kind of sad at the same time because like the world is just telling us that like we're not doing the most, like we're not nurses and we're not doctors and lawyers and well, some of us are, but it's like people are constantly judging and we constantly feel the need to prove that we're doing the most. But it's like, why is that so necessary? Like, why do we have to like prove anything, you know?
Yeah, especially when, like, we kind of are doing, like, because people are always, like, Patrick, you always make a good point. It's like, try and go without art for a day if you think we're that useless, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, like, that was one thing that's, like, really frustrating to me is, like, I've had a few conversations with people who have some very, I'll just fucking go for it, immoral views on life and politics, and her just kind of, you know, against upping the minimum wage and everything, who are just like, oh, well, you know, that person who works at McDonald's isn't contributing that much to society. And I'm like, and fucking you doing some financial bullshit are contributing to society more than someone who's feeding people.
Literally.
I beg to differ. But, and so it's just, it's infuriating. And so that's kind of where like my perspective and like my, like, having to have those conversations and be like, okay, so, and also just, you know, being creative at some extent kind of thing. And just kind of having that question of like, oh, so you do this, like, it's like, oh, I do music and stuff. It's like, well, what do you do? And it's like, fuck off. What if I'm going to, you know, it's not easy to kind of make art like a career and it's borderline impossible in a lot of senses, but then people totally like undervalue it. And like, that's where it's like, okay, so you don't value paying people for, you know, their drawings, their paintings, their music and stuff. Fucking delete Spotify.
Right.
Don't use it. Don't use your radio. Drive in silence. Like,
ears, so you never listen to music again.
Yeah. Like, and so that's like, it's exciting to see, but it's, I mean, it's that's what's super, you know, the nice side of social media, like TikTok, is you're seeing all of these, you know, short little like speed videos of, you know, of someone like drawing and all the work that goes into it. And I think that that's so incredibly important for all of us just to kind of see those little, the basically the behind the scenes look that And like you're saying, like, it's proof that we are always doing something, and that's that documentation. And it's, but at the same time, it's shitty that we kind of are like required to do that, you know, for people to like really believe that we're contributing to society.
And then we come back to that question of, what do you do? And it's like, what do you mean, what do I do? What do I spend all of my time doing? Like, thinking about art, making art, contemplating, looking at, like, you know, like, this is what I'm spending my time doing. What do you mean? What am I contributing to society? I'm contributing that too. Come on, man.
Yeah.
Honestly, you know what? When people say things like that, I think they really don't understand what they're really saying. Like, they're obviously not educated on literally all of the creative aspects that go on in their lives, from the design of their phone to the design of their shoes, the design of their home. Without creative people, they honestly, I don't think anyone would survive, honestly.
No, and I think it's also, it's just from the people who make comments like that, what they're kind of not willing to admit is that by, when they say contributing to society, they mean, it's almost like there's like a salary, like money value benchmark.
Oh, it's that totally
yeah, it's economically based. And it's like, if you make more than this much money, you're contributing to society. And they're never going to admit that, but that's literally what they're saying, because like, they don't understand that the working class is that minimum wage, you know, labor. It's the, you know, the, there's a reason that we need the minimum wage to be upped, and there's going to be other economic, like, what's it called? Effects from just raising that. But the fact that we're in the situation in the first place is because people like that are literally oppressing the, we're getting pretty commie here. I'm about it, but welcome to our communist art podcast.
See, it's all the means of production. No, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, Patrick. I agree with everything that you just said.
Yeah. It's,
and I'm sure like most creative people would as well.
Yeah. Cause it's funny. Cause like I've talked about this with a couple coworkers and stuff. Cause like we don't work, or at least I don't work in like a that much above minimum wage job, but basically like it's, that's where you find a lot of the creative people, because we don't, you know, it's, there's not like an hourly paid job most of the time for like an artist. It's a lot more complicated than that. And it's usually just paying for the completed product as opposed to like the hourly work that you put in, which is kind of, I mean, I guess until you get to a certain level, like with music, it's more or less like you can get paid to, you get paid by a show or like per show or like per recording hour or something like that, studio time and everything. And then half the time, like especially with studio time, is you're just getting paid by other artists and creatives. So it's like we have our own little like economic circle. And then it's, you know, you have like a couple people within our economic circle who get paid exorbitant amounts of money from like the general public. And those are like your pop stars, your, but even then half of the money that they make gets, you know, absorbed by record labels and everything, which, but which is exciting to see that the, you know, the independent label, the independent artist is really taking off, because like, again, as I think I brought this up with Tim and like how we talked to Sophie last week, was that we have so like the amount of technology available to us, like this is coming from like the music aspect, and like the music industry has like drastically changed in the past like 30 years, thanks to iTunes was what kicked it off, and LimeWire, rip, but. But like, it's, you know, it's wild to think, because like Tim brought up, he's like, I have more technology than the Beatles had in my bedroom. So, and like, we have the capability to just create incredible sounding recordings and just go from there. Like, the only reason you really need a record label is for distribution and reaching the masses, which is, you know, frustrating, but it's not the same as it used to be, which is exciting to see.
That's interesting. So that's why like some people decide not to, I guess, pursue major record labels and rather just like be independent?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most prevalent example is definitely Chance the Rapper, who's completely independent, and he made it. I mean, you could probably ask most people and they'd know exactly who he is. And he's independent. He's not signed to a record label. He made it, I think, basically kind of just essentially DIY. And I know people who are signed to record labels and everything. And it's interesting because it's a contract. And then like the amount of stuff that you're able to release, it's binding to an extent. And that's the one thing that I've heard is really frustrating. Because like, yes, it unlocks extra resources that are available to you, but there's also the the possibility that you don't technically own your music. And like, you're seeing that kind of stuff with like Taylor Swift re-recording her whole basically discography with her dispute. And when it comes to a lot of financial legal battles in the music scene, 9 times out of 10, like if it's between the artist and the record label and it's some bullshit frat bro exec trying to manipulate and basically take advantage of and exploit these artists for their work. Like, and I think, it's frustrating. But I mean, that's why I haven't checked in on this, but I hope Victory Records, either the guy who owns Victory Records is out of Victory Records, or Victory Records, the label itself, is dead. Because they have been heinous about it. And that was the one thing that I remember in high school. I was a big pop punk guy. So following the whole A Day to Remember fiasco, because they had a huge issue and they won their lawsuit and got out of that record label. And I think they helped pull, but like Victory Records like sank Hawthorne Heights. Because
what happened to Hawthorne Heights? Tell me about this.
There was like a record label where essentially Victory Records will go around and find young talent, you know, people who are like bands who are at like the age of like 16 to 18 who are starting to pop off in like regional areas, and then sign them. And like, those kids don't know any better. It's like, oh, a 5 album deal. And then, you know, your record label helps control all of your marketing and your public outreach. And especially in like the early to mid 2000s, when social media was starting to pick up, but it's not prevalent like it is today.
Yeah.
So I think that basically they had a disagreement with the owner, and the owner just kind of cut a lot of their basically window to the public. And so they just kind of fell off the face of the earth. It wasn't there. Yeah. It's not that they wanted to stop making music or anything, but you know, if you have money, you have power, and that's fucked.
So that's what happened to them. That's why no one hears from them anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to double check and make sure that it is Hawthorne Heights, that I'm not just, there is definitely,
I mean, I haven't heard about them in a hot minute.
Yeah. Cause some of those bands just kind of, you know, they stop making stuff and, but
I don't know. It's, you get into this weird territory of like, literally like becoming more of a, I say producer in like a term of like, you're just making things for this other person to use, which is always like a really interesting thing, which some people are really into that. They're like, just let me make things and you do everything. But like, it kind of gets into a weird territory for me where I feel so like every like little painting I make, I don't know how you guys feel, is like literally like my little child, you know?
Yes.
Like putting it out there, like, is always really scary. Like I'm sending my kid off to middle school, you know, like people might bully him, like, and like in my studio, they're safe, they're at home. But like the idea of giving them to somebody else to do with sort of as they please. Cause like you're saying, Patrick, there's not a lot of power in some of those situations. Sometimes you can get lucky and it's a really, nice collaborative effort. And there's like definitely things that exist like that in like, you know, factions of whatever that word is that I can't think of, but, yeah. I mean, I don't know how you guys feel, if you're that attached to the things that you make, or if you would be like okay with letting someone do everything and you could just sit there and make art. Like,
Honestly, I struggle with that a lot. And I think with us, like drawers and painters, especially, like our work is very precious to us because we spend so long on them. Mm-hmm. Like that piece behind you, you must have spent like days and days and days, maybe weeks.
Oh my gosh, all the time. And it's still not done. That's the thing, right? Oh man.
It's just like when you spend so long with either a person or a thing or anything, like you're going to grow attached to that. And I think it's completely normal to feel that way towards your art. Mm-hmm. But then interestingly, people in other like creative professions see their art in a different way where it's like they're not super attached to their work. And if like in ceramics, right? If the work breaks in the kiln, you just have to move on.
Like, yeah, that's a good comparison.
So yeah, I don't know, like it's super interesting to see how some people are super attached with their work, but then some people are like, I literally gotta move on, like I don't have time. I wish I was like that. I'm not personally like that.
Yeah, I feel you. Cause it's like, I guess when you take certain aspects of things ceramicists do, like people who would sit down in a day and like make like 40 mugs or something, and like mm-hmm. that's an instance where it's literally designed to be given to people, you yeah. know? And a lot of times I make art like with this sort of idea in the back of my head, like, oh, I could sell this, but then I'm like, but then like, well, how much would I sell it for? Who would I give it to? Like, do I really want to part with it? Do I like versus those sort of junctures where you literally are creating things to like have many of the same thing or unique things and give them to others, sell them to others specifically, but like share them regardless.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's interesting too, that you brought in like the ceramics and stuff. I'd never thought about that because like for music, like I get attached to like my songs and stuff and recordings, but then I feel mm-hmm. like it's, you know, like I'm totally more comfortable to like perform the song at like a show. And then it's almost just like a temporary share kind of thing. Because it's like this rendition, this version of this song essentially exists basically as a memory or like a moment in time. And that's it. But then like recording, like, I don't know, it's like this song is my child and I get attached to it. But then I also get maybe attached to it to the point where I'm just like, well, if people don't like it, that might sour my relationship with the song and like my self-esteem kind of thing. So like that's kind of where, I don't know.
No, that's actually really interesting thinking about the difference between the experience of a live performance and the I can't think of a word, but like the objectness of a yeah. recording. I don't know.
Yeah, like the recording as an object, like mm-hmm. that's really interesting to approach because it's such like music is such an ephemeral thing, like you can't touch it, you can't mm-hmm. grab it, but like you can literally spend months and years writing a song, you can literally spend so much time making a song even though you can't physically touch it. So that's really interesting that Patrick, that you see your music sort of like as your child like Beth does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's like I like that, you know, kind of like you have like this deep connection. And I guess like for like any kind of art that you create, whatever you make in that moment or that time, it's just like a reflection of you and who you are and what you're going through at that like specific moment. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one thing that's like, you know, it's very interesting. And I'd imagine it would be similar to you if you like revisited like an old sketchbook or if you looked back at like old paintings and stuff that you'd done like years in the past. But like for me, it's like, if I, you know, work on playing a song that I wrote 4 years ago, mm-hmm. If I have like an established connection and it has like that, you know, my like a real level of authenticity that I am really proud of, it can just like transport me back to that moment in time and be like, oh, I remember, you know, kind of what inspired me to write this song. I remember what was going on.
Yeah.
And it kind of like can transport you back, which is, you know, kind of exciting. And it also kind of, you know, it's just got this tie with like a certain moment of you know, certain emotion or certain time in your life. And I think that's one thing that's really, you know, beautiful about art is that in any kind of medium, like it can speak to you in some, you know, way. And then if it touches you in a very specific way, like a vulnerable part in your life, no matter when you look at it later on in life, it can kind of remind you of like, oh, I was having a tough time, and just kind of, you know, viewing this painting and getting some kind of interpretation from it helped me basically untangle something within myself and move forward. So I don't know. It's
honestly, when I look at my sketchbooks, usually I say, what the fuck was I drawing? Like, why did I draw this arm that way? Like, it's so ugly. What? Why do I have this?
Oh,
I mean, to an extent, I think a lot of people do that. They're like, oh, I should have fixed this part. Oh, I should have fixed that part. But I guess, I mean, I keep my old drawings as a learning sort of reminder, as like to record how far I've come. You know what I mean? Because personally, I don't really like having that many things, like holding on to that many things from my past, like physical objects. I'd rather not have that much stuff, if that makes sense. So actually, this is like probably really bad. I threw away a lot of my sketchbooks from like years ago. Yeah, I threw them away.
That's so interesting, Rudy, because I am literally the exact opposite. Like, Patrick's talking about the sort of nostalgia of old projects and the old feelings and stuff. Like, I love going through my old sketchbooks, even when they're terrible. I'm like, oh, like this bitch, like definitely didn't, what, like wasn't doing the right thing at this moment. But like, I remember sitting down and drawing that and like feeling this way about it. And like, I love going through old shit, even like old. I'm someone who literally still has my like binders and stuff from like high school, you know, like it's probably because I'm a hoarder, but also because I'm extremely nostalgic in that way. But that's so interesting to me that you're like, well, I can move on from this now. I've learned what I can and I don't need this anymore.
Man, it's like, I wasn't always like that. Like, I used to be like you. I used to have so many sketchbooks and stuff from high school. And I have some from high school, like not a lot, like not all of them. But it, to me, it's just like, it just takes up so much space mentally and physically for me.
That's
valid. And I work smoother if I know in the back of my mind, like that I have everything I need rather than have everything like just from my entire life. To me, it's like, I mean, it's not the only way of like being an artist. Like, you don't, you obviously, like, obviously you, Beth, you're a super talented artist, and because you kept everything. You literally have a record of everything that you've ever made. But for me, it's like, I just, it frustrates me to like have boxes and boxes and boxes of all my ugly old drawings. And I'm not gonna pretend like all my drawings are like made out of gold. So I just like keep the ones where like I can look back and be like, oh, like this curve is really good, or this line is like something I can learn from. Like, I keep those. But you know what, have you guys seen that show on Netflix, Marie Kondo, what, the art of tidying up? Have you guys?
Oh yeah.
She's like, if it does not bring joy, then throw it away. If a drawing like just doesn't give me that much joy, if it's just like, oh, this is a cute little drawing, but I don't really like feel super happy looking at it, I'll just throw it away, honestly. What is you guys' opinion on that?
Well, I guess, because I've thought about this before, and it's like, I keep all of my old shit because it makes me so happy. Like, I don't know, I get really excited thinking, like, going through old shit and being, because I've gone through so many, like, character arcs in my art. Like, from this year to this year, I was sort of obsessed with this. From this year to this year, I was, like, doing this stuff, and this was really the focus of my art. And I love going back on those journeys and, like, being able, like, having old books on my shelf. Like, I remember watching some of those episodes, and one of the guys, like, literally got rid of, like, a good chunk of his book collection, which I guess is healthy in this idea of like decluttering your life and not having all of these things to keep like weighing you down, I guess. But I don't feel like they're in my way, you know?
That's great.
I don't know. What about you, yeah. Patrick?
I think that this is actually, I really like this conversation because I'm like the odd one out here. So when I used to write lyrics in like notebooks and stuff and like chord charts and stuff for the songs when I was in high school, and I don't have those anymore, whether they got lost or forgotten somewhere. I just don't have them. But also like, I don't have like a sketchbook or anything. Mm. And a lot of like my old lyrics and stuff or old demos I just have on my phone. So like my voice memo, I have like this huge, basically huge folder of voice memos on my phone of just like trying out like a song, like here's a chord progression and like a verse, and this is like a jumping off point for a song. Or in my notes app, it's filled with random, like basically like I did this like a couple months ago where I went all the way back to like a note from like 2014, 2015 or something. And it was just like this huge stream of consciousness essay about like things that I thought would be good ideas to like just random thoughts that were kind of like jumping off points for songs of like, mm-hmm. whether it was like some kind of metaphor or like trying to encapsulate some kind of emotion or feeling in like a couple words or like a sentence. So for me, it's, I don't get like, and also with it, this would have been different if you'd asked me that question. And, you know, maybe if we were existing in like 2005 right now, because then I'd imagine I would have an obscene amount collection of like CDs of just random demos or like half recorded songs. Yeah. But a lot of my art is computer files right now, which is terrifying to an extent because actually, you know what? I think that the EP that I recorded and bested the album artwork for, I don't think I have the final files for that, because between releasing that and now, I spilt adult grape juice on that laptop.
Oh no.
And so I had to get a new laptop. So, you know, I now am using the cloud a lot more often and responsibly as backups. So, but like a lot of, it's like they're all, and that was also something that was interesting with you guys talking about, like when you were talking about kind of like documenting and stuff. Like for me, like, I don't know, I kind of, part of me wants to, and certain times I do where I have like, oh, version 3.4 of this song or something, where I try and, you know, add a vibra slap or something in the middle of a song, and then it goes in like a different direction or something on the recording. But like, I don't have like that version history of each song. So it's usually either like, basically like, for instance, like how I do the podcast, what I'm trying to do is always have two versions. So I have just the raw track, so basically like unedited, just all of our audio in one file. And then I create a copy of that, and that's the one that I edit down. Mm-hmm. Because then if I mess up too bad on like the editing or something, I can go back and start again. So I always kind of try and do that. But sometimes like if you get too far into the editing process and you, or like mixing process for a song, and you don't have that raw file, kind of got to record again. So I don't know, it's interesting that you guys are talking about that, because I just don't have the clutter really of, you know, if I were to have like a whole bunch of old sketchbooks, I don't have the sketchbooks per se, since it's all in like my notes.
Yeah, your writing lyrics isn't a manuscript that you're like editing by hand. It's on your phone, you know. Yeah. Which, like you were saying, is pretty scary when you spill grape juice on your laptop and lose everything. Like, that's how I lost my novel, you know.
You lost an entire novel?
Yeah, I have like part of it still, but I have the part that wasn't finished, that wasn't edited, that wasn't submitted, that wasn't, you know. So it's like, I don't even remember what I missed. I just know that there's so much that happened on my Word doc that I lost. And it's just the digitalization of things that are so vulnerable, I guess, to an extent, is a little frightening. Even on the cloud, like one of my big fears is like losing the internet, and like
things
like that, like power, EMPs, like I'm not gonna get into it, but that's like
what happens if all the servers for Spotify go down and music catalogs are lost forever.
Yeah, like
the scary thing about digitization.
Playlists. That's kind of why I like making traditional art so much these days, is that it feels more real. Like Rudy, I don't know how much digital art you do. I know you do a lot of traditional art as well. How do you feel about that?
I would say that, okay, this sounds kind of weird. So I used to, when I first enrolled at CU Boulder, I wasn't an art major. I was actually an English major. Okay. And we read this thing in one of the classes called the Cyborg Manifesto. Have you guys heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it was written by this woman who, it was like a feminist piece, an intersectional feminism piece. But basically it was saying that like now in this day and age, we all exist as cyborgs because to some extent we are part technology, and without that technology, we would basically not function. So I would say like for the average person that like maybe doesn't do digital art, like they're still kind of part cyborg because like we all have this digital persona. Whether it's like super, super, super fabricated, like Lady Gaga or Grimes or someone with like a super fantastical persona, or whether it's not fabricated, maybe like you just have an Instagram where you just take pictures of your lunch. Either way, it's like you still exist as this like technological persona at least half of the time.
Mm.
So I would say like, to an extent, yes. What was your question? Can you repeat that question?
I was just wondering how you feel about making like physical things instead of relying on things existing online.
Oh, I see.
I really like this tangent.
Honestly, if I had the means, I don't have like a digital editing computer right now. Like I don't have a giant Mac computer or desktop or PC right now. But I really used to fool around with Photoshop and Illustrator in the basement floor of the VAC. Like,
yes.
I used to just love, like, I would stay there till like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning just doing BS. Like, honestly, BS, just wanted to fool around. But I think I used to be the kind of person that was like, oh, digital art is shit because you're not actually buying paint and you don't have to mix your colors and you don't have to like buy paper. I used to be that like troll person.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, I was very, very like extremist with traditional art, especially in high school. I was like, digital art, like that's for pansies, like that doesn't require any skill. But now in college I was like, actually, it requires like maybe just as much or maybe even more skill than traditional art, because you have to know how to work so many different programs, so many different textures, pens, computers. I have like such a respect for people that do digital art. But to be completely honest, I'm always going to be a person that will treasure traditional art over digital art. Because that's what made me fall in love with art. Traditional animation is what made me fall in love with traditional art. Even before like I even knew what the hell traditional animation was. I don't know if you guys like grew up watching any cartoons, but for me it was like Pokemon, like
yes.
Pokemon Indigo League, like Pokemon Johto, and then all the Studio Ghibli movies. That's what like made me fall in love with art, and that's basically why I even draw today. Like if I never watched those things, those hand-drawn beautiful frame-by-frame animations, then I don't think I would even like be here right now talking to you guys. So what do you guys think about that?
my callback to inspiration of traditional animation was the, well, I think there were some digital elements in this movie, but it was definitely, anyway, the Spirit Stallion of the Cimarron movie. Iconic. On my DVD, there was a like special features where James Baxter was literally teaching you how to draw Spirit the Horse, and that changed my life. Like, to learn from James Baxter, like in his little studio, was like, even on a DVD, literally for kids, was fucking cool. Like,
whoa. Iconic. I didn't know James Baxter did that.
Mm-hmm. That's why it's so amazing.
Wait, is that why in Adventure Time?
I was literally just doing drawing the same connecting line.
Oh my god, it's a conspiracy.
Oh yeah, the James Baxter horse.
Yeah, what? Oh my god, that was a reference. That was a very intense reference. Thank you, Beth, for like enlightening us.
Wow.
I'm happy to.
My god.
12 of our followers watch Sailing of the Cimarron.
Right? It's a classic American movie. You have to watch Spirit.
It's everyone so good. Watch
Spirit right now, or you cannot listen to the next episode of this podcast.
Download the Brian album or Adam's album for it. Like, who did that? I don't know. Great soundtrack. Oh, now I'm just thinking about that movie. Anyway, growing up on cartoons, I think that's something we really relate to. Like, especially like. In our generation when like cartoons like started becoming more of a like a routine thing, because compared to like our parents' cartoons that they had when if they had I don't know
yeah because I feel like
fuzzy
I feel like it's like, you know, our parents, it was all like the Saturday morning cartoons kind of thing, and then for us it was a lot more like there was always some kind of cartoon on, and then we also were the generation that grew up with, you know, going from there into like Toonami and Adult Swim. And we were, yes. I would argue Toonami. That we were exposed to more versions and artistic styles of cartoon than like our parents were. And I feel like that was something that, you know, this is me just speculating now, but like was able to influence and inspire to a deeper level because we were exposed to so many different styles. Whereas like I'd imagine our parents more or less, it was like the Disney kind of stuff or the Hanna-Barbera and just those kind of things. And then we had channels like Boomerang where it was all of the classic Hanna-Barbera, but then we also had access to these like anime and modern American cartoon, whether it be the wacky Cartoon Network, whatever they're throwing at us, or SpongeBob on Nickelodeon and stuff. So it was just kind of this huge, it was a bigger market. So, and in the 90s, I think too, is just economically for the straight white males of the world was very not problematic, and there wasn't like economically everything was going better, and so you had more of like an artistic boom around that period for a small sector of the people who existed during that time. But we still got to see some kind of artistic renaissance, and I think that's was kind of, you know, we have like, it's interesting that you bring up cartoons from childhood, because I feel like a lot of us have, you know, stemmed from that. Like Cameron talked about how he, you know, just the nostalgia of sitting down and watching hours of Adult Swim bullshit whatever weird shit they had on back when we were like 12, and then that's kind of what pushed him further down the graphic design path.
That makes a lot of sense. I feel like that's like cartoons and animation was probably like most people's introduction to anything creative besides like having to play the recorder in the third grade. That was like the most creativity anyone was probably exposed to from our generation, like I guess the late millennial slash early Gen Z generation.
Yeah, and what I think it's,
have you guys been watching like now, like what are you guys watching right now?
Critical Role, next question. Sorry, what about you, Patrick?
Oh man, I'm kind of like almost in between shows at the moment, so I've been bouncing around. I need, unfortunately I switched from Netflix to like Hulu.
Did you say unfortunately?
Yes, because Bo Burnham just released a new special that I need to watch and cry about.
Oh, yeah.
And it's on Netflix and I have Hulu right now, but yeah, I guess I've talked to a couple people about this. Is like, I haven't gotten into like another cartoon or anime recently. I just haven't had something like fully grasp my attention. Like I went on like a run a little while ago where I just went diving through Hunter x Hunter and Neon Genesis and Cowboy Bebop and just like one after the other. And then I rewatched Adventure Time, which is like my favorite. And I watched She-Ra because of Sara, watching her freak out about it on Twitter. And you guys all still need to watch She-Ra. That one's incredible. Yes. It's on Netflix. Oh my God.
Well, the voice actress for She-Ra is going to be on Critical Role's next venture. So now I finally have a tie. That gives me an excuse.
There we go.
Yes.
Well, now I'm going to loop Sara in with that and that she'll get hooked.
Yes. Tales of Exandria.
But yeah, like right now I'm kind of watching Dave on Hulu. Had a few people recommend that and I'd watch like the first episode. It's pretty goofy, but I don't know. I don't have like one that I'm like hardcore binging at the moment. So I'm open for recommendations.
I'm also watching Drive to Survive, which my brother got me into. These aren't cartoons. I don't really watch cartoons that much these days because I'm so focused on the other things that I'm obsessed with. But I definitely want to watch She-Ra. I want to watch all of Adventure Time too, Patrick. You got me.
You should.
Yeah.
I actually
have a lot of fun memories watching random episodes and stuff.
But exactly. That's how I got hooked. Because what was it at my old house? Everyone I lived with, we all like had our period where we sat down and watched it front to back. But like what would happen is it was like, so basically it was like constantly playing at our house for like 3 years. And I would catch like random episodes. And like the Islands arc was the first one that I watched, sat down and watched with my roommate, Connor. And it like emotionally, personally attacked me. And I was like, okay, the fuck? I need to figure out what's going on here. And then I sat down and watched it front to back. But it's just so good. It's such a good show. And I think this is a point I kind of wanted to, you know, see if you guys maybe felt this as well. It's like, I feel like this is our generation is kind of the first one that had developed cartoons for adults, essentially, because you see, like, I'm sure there was like Adult Swim existed, but like, I think like the 90s and early 2000s are when cartoons kind of started to exist a lot more for everybody. And it wasn't just like, oh, it's just for kids. Cause you had, you know, everything, like, everything on Adult Swim. You had, you know, more mature anime coming through on Toonami. You had, you know, all these different studios who were creating for not just the kids, which I think was like a very American kind of perception, but you see shows that can touch like everybody, like Avatar, or you have ones that are pointed directly at adults like Family Guy or The Simpsons or Rick and Morty and stuff. And I feel like you didn't get quite as much of that before essentially our generation. So do you think that's kind of tied with our, you know, kind of unique and more explosive cartoon upbringing?
You know what? That's an excellent point. You know, it's like, I never think about how the nature of cartoons has just like completely did a 180 in terms of like audience. And the fact of like us as adults watching cartoons in our 20s, just wouldn't be a thing like maybe 20 years ago. Like it wouldn't have been a thing. People would have been like, do I need to call the hospital? Why are you watching cartoons for children? But it's like, now it's like your buddy will ask you, your like 36-year-old buddy will ask you like, hey, did you catch the new Samurai Jack reboot thing?
Oh, yes.
And it's like, so I love having those conversations because like, I don't know about you guys' experience in like middle and high school, but anime wasn't that popular as it is now. It's like, oh, if you watched anime, you were like the weird kid and you were pretty much a nerd and people didn't talk to you unless they also watched anime. But now it's like more socially acceptable to watch it for some reason.
No, I remember going to like high school things and seeing like the anime club 10 and being like, oh my God, the anime club 10, you guys, like, fuck it. And now it's like, oh yeah, you know, like, what's the last one you watched?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That was such an interesting thing because like, I wasn't like super into anime or anything in like high school or middle school, but I do remember like, it was that, you know, it was just interesting to watch almost like a cultural and societal like flip. Mm-hmm. Of how people view those shows and everything. And then it was like, I feel like when we got to college, it became like the coolest thing for everyone to do.
Exactly. Well, yeah. I think it sort of brought this sense of community, you know, like we talk about that a lot, but like, seriously, like when you and somebody else watch and enjoy the same thing, that creates a connection that like, you don't always get like for other random things. Like, it's like, oh, you like, how do you feel about the show? What's your favorite character? Like, are you excited about the new season? Like, you know, like you were saying, Rudy, with that example you have of like, oh, did you hear about the Samurai Jack reboot? Like, that's something people can relate to when you sort of have this connection, or like wearing your show's t-shirt out and people being like, oh, fuck yes, you know?
Right, yes. Oh my God.
That happens to me sometimes at work, that people come in and see my, sorry, talking about Critical Role again. It's just creating those connections and being like, oh my God, cannot believe what happened last episode. I love that shit. I live for that shit.
Yeah, and I mean, you get the same thing with, you know, on Music End when you wear a band shirt or something and that was a, you know, he's like, oh, did you go to that show last week or something? He's like, yeah, I was there. And it's, you know, expressing art and finding community through your art and the art that you appreciate is, you know, it kind of feels like finding a home, you know?
Yeah.
These are my people.
Honestly, I don't know if you guys have like been like, I guess you have, you must have like at least looked at my Instagram page at least once, but recently I've been on this like Y2K style sort of art, because actually all the cartoons that I watched, and some of them you mentioned, Patrick, like Neon Genesis Evangelion, Cowboy Bebop, Hunter x Hunter, and there's this other one called Cardcaptor Sakura, like those old school, like late 90s, early 2000s sort of vibe cartoons and video games. That's kind of been like what I've been exploring artistically. Yeah. Because to me, it's like, that's my, I guess, nostalgic thing that I go back to. Like at the end of the day, like when I'm tired, I'll be like, you know what? I need to watch some like cutesy magical girl anime or something like with a lot of pink in it. With sparkles and like Sailor Moon transformations. I just need to go back and I need to take my mind off things and watch some Sailor Moon. And then like, I was like, I don't know why I'm so into it, but I want to make art about it. And then I've been like drawing this little boy named Kiko. He's like in a lot of my paintings, but he's kind of like inspired by that generation of cartoon and video game. And I think that style isn't something that anyone would recognize outside of our generation. Maybe like older millennials might recognize it, but I don't really mind that. Like, I just went on a giant tangent. I am so sorry.
That's actually the point of the podcast.
Well, it's also, I love that you're talking about that, because I noticed that actually going through your stuff, because I, you know, I've seen like your art for like a long time and recently found you again on Instagram. Yeah. And I've seen your character, and I've seen this sort of style that is, now that you mentioned those specific things, pretty reminiscent of that. And I was like, what brought Rudy here? Like, I'm like, what's like, what is she exploring now? And I love that you're saying that you're exploring these nostalgic things, because that's what I've been doing myself. And I'm curious when that started for you, because for me personally, I know I started sort of going back into this nostalgic sort of reflection and study of things. Definitely like when like during like quarantine lockdown, I was just focused on like things that brought me a lot of comfort and like things that I could spend a lot of time sort of meditating on. Yeah, that's.
I'd say it all probably started for me in college.
Yeah.
Okay. It started when I first started to take my digital arts classes. Like I think I took two of them, maybe three. But my friend recommended to me the show Cardcaptor Sakura. He's like, oh, I used to watch this when I was younger. It's about this girl who collects cards because like she opens a magical book in her father's study, and then like when she opens it, all the cards like disperse throughout the city and she has to go and hunt them down, otherwise the city will just be in chaos.
Interesting.
So she has to go hunt these cards, but this anime was made in the late 90s. So when I first saw it, when I first heard of it, I was like, yeah, I've heard of that anime, but it looks kind of old. I'm not really into old anime. I need something new. I need something with like action-y punches.
Hmm.
And like you can see like the blood spatters and the tooth falling out. Like, I need something with a lot of graphic detail. I used action. To be a person. But like I gave it a chance and I was like, this is so cute and so wholesome. This is like what I've been missing in my life.
Hmm.
And then I just started getting into that aesthetic. I started watching other shows like that. I started getting more into Sailor Moon, more into 90s, like just like 90s animes. Like there's this other cool one. It's called Serial Experiments Lane. And it's like about this girl who gets a computer, but she slowly becomes like the god of the internet.
Okay.
I won't spoil it. It's actually really good. But it's just like a 90s anime that just has this otherworldly feel because it's hand-drawn.
Yes.
And it gives it a sense of like timelessness that I think digital animation just cannot really capture 100%. So I think for me, it really started in college when I was still exploring myself artistically.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of people don't really find their style in college, because I definitely didn't find my style until after I left.
Yeah.
So because like your professors are like breathing down your back like, oh, you need to do this. Oh, what about the painting you did last time? Why didn't you do that again?
Yes. It's like you're constantly like being pulled in all these different directions.
Exactly. I felt like so stretched out, so thin. Like you can't find yourself if someone is telling you to find yourself. Like that's, if it was that easy, then we would all be millionaires at this point. But honestly, it wasn't until after I left college. It started in college, but it wasn't until after I left where I had time to like do whatever I wanted artistically,
mm-hmm.
and explore whatever style I wanted without the repercussion of, is my professor gonna make me cry or something like that, because he didn't like the way I drew this one line or it didn't make any sense cohesively. Yeah, that's where it really started for me.
Well, I'm just glad you were able to like keep exploring your art, you know, because sometimes people go through art school and don't they lose it, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
So like, I'm glad we're all able to like keep exploring our art, like even though we've been doing it for like so long. But I'm to dive into your story a little bit, you said you started school not as an art major where I met you, but doing like English stuff. And mm-hmm. what made you decide to pursue art like as a whole? Cause like, even now, like your Instagram is dedicated to art. Like you've got that little artist hashtag, you know, like this is what you're doing. Like what brought you here? Tell me, Rudy.
I would say I used to be in love with writing. This is like really embarrassing to say. I was one of those kids in middle school that would like do the role playing Like,
oh no, that is literally same. Like, I fucking loved role-playing, bitch.
It was fun, but to me, like, the words I typed were just so cringy in the moment. Now I look back and I'm like, why did I do that? Like, that's disgusting. Why did I type that?
That's just the middle school. Like, like, I feel like everybody, no matter what you were into in middle school, was just a giant cringe fest. And I guess, like, maybe we all just have to do that to figure to move on in life. But I'm glad that we can all look back, or at least most people can look back, because I was definitely the same way with just like how I was as a person, like, reacting to my friends, the songs I wrote. That's the, like, one period that I can't really like when I started writing songs, and it's just like I enjoy revisiting certain songs, and sometimes there's a few select ones from high school that I'm like, okay, but then that I draw the line at like 15 years old and before. I'm like,
yeah, super cringy. Like, I guess you do have to go through that period of just growing up and learning what is, like, I don't want to say the word socially acceptable, but like, what is okay? What part of yourself is okay to not share, and what part of yourself is okay to share? Like, it all comes down to like what you feel comfortable with. But for me, it was super cringy. Like, there's some people that, like, if they were to publish what they typed in middle school, like, they would be millionaires. That certainly was not me. I was typing like really cringy stuff. But anyways, to get back to your question, Beth, I was super into writing in middle school and high school. I was also doing art, but I always, in school, I thought of it as a hobby, rather than something that, like, I would pursue professionally. I always had the opinion, like, oh, I don't need to get a degree in art because I can just do it myself and I'll just be successful 100% just me. But I went into college thinking that, and I took these English classes, and then I was like, I regret doing this. Like, I would rather be making art right now. I do not want to type a 10-page essay on this film that I watched like half asleep. So like my entire freshman year, I was an English major, and then I decided to switch art my sophomore year because I used to, okay, when I was 10, this is another tangent, and it's not smooth, and it's not like, it's just very bumpy tangents from here on out. when I was 10, I started to draw these comics. Like, I just loved drawing comics. I was like that kid in the corner that just like would not talk to anyone, but she would just be silently drawing some weird thing, like, just that just popped up in her head. I was that little girl.
So relatable.
Yeah, right. And then I'm still drawing comics now, but it's like much slower because obviously I'm not 10 anymore and I have other shit to do. Like, I can't be just drawing random comics all the time. But that's where, like, see, that's where my English and my art interest like combine, because I'm writing the scripts for these comics and I'm doing the research and I'm like world building and I'm designing like all by myself. And that's kind of like where they both are like met at a strange sort of marriage. And honestly, I would not have it any other way. Like, I don't regret being an English major. I don't regret taking those classes. I don't regret switching to art when I did. Just zero regrets.
No regrets.
Yeah, but that's my story.
I love hearing that, because I feel like that's kind of almost a common theme with people that we have on the podcast, is like going into specifically college for one thing and then being like, no, I don't want to do this, and then switching to other, whether it be like in Cameron's instance where he's like, oh, I'll follow my dad's footsteps and do engineering, and then he just has one shitty day before college, be like, fuck engineering, I'm gonna do art. And then I think that's just super fascinating to, you know, just the thing that you're most passionate about will essentially prevail and, you know, figure it out. And you see stories like that, that are just, and it's great to see stories like that. Like, what's his face from Game of Thrones? Plays Tyrion. Cause he was like a software engineer. Like,
yeah.
One day he was just like, I want to be an actor, and fucking walked off and did it.
Fuck
and
yeah.
I just find that like super cool. Like stories like that. It's, I love it.
Like, I guess like as you get older, cause we think about this sort of catalyst in our experiences of going to college, of being able to be like, well, now I'm literally dedicating all of my time to this instead of these sort of like broken up, like different things that we were doing in like elementary, middle school, high school, and being able to choose what we wanted to do, you know, and spend our time studying and learning, which is always really exciting to get that opportunity and to be able to choose it.
Yes.
Which I think is something that we're all lucky to be able to pursue the things that we wanted to, you know, even in the interesting circumstances that college brings about. Rudy, I'm sure you know what I mean. but like still being able to do it.
Yep.
Yeah.
I agree with you. It's even like as art majors, I feel like sometimes just life gets in the way, and that takes a giant toll on your artwork. Like if you go through a breakup or if something's going on in your family, unfortunately, like sometimes your art suffers, but actually sometimes it's like that actually makes your art even powerful, more potent. But it's so interesting because I think art is one of the few areas of study where it's like so heavily dependent on your state of mind. Yeah. That's really interesting though.
Yeah, because that definitely would show like, you know, in the things that we made or the critiques that we have or like the way people would react to things and be like, dude, or like, you know, be and just, I don't know. You're right. Yeah. Things show up in your art, whether you're intending them to or not, which is always kind of interesting.
That's true. And also like I guess the way people perceived our art like during critique, maybe it was like also had to do with their mood for that day.
Oh,
like,
definitely what they were going through. Yeah
So that's also very interesting. Like if someone like was just having a shitty day, I'm sure like they could take it out on you by just like ripping you apart in crit or
you
something.
Fucking suck, man. Like,
I know, right? Man. But it's like, it's an interesting opportunity to voice your opinions, I guess. And you don't really get that opportunity in other areas of study. So I guess we're kind of lucky in that sense.
Yeah, you didn't have like class critiques doing some of the things you did you, Patrick? Because like obviously we all put up our art on the wall and everyone sat down and we all talked about it. Like, did you guys have that kind of experience?
Not particularly. I guess the one thing that was kind of, so I studied aerospace at CU for a little while and burned the fuck out. but that was kind of cool though, because there still was an element of design and creativity with some of the stuff that we did, which looking back, I think it's probably what kept me like so attached to it. Like our labs, I loved doing. One, we did like the bottle rocket design, because you could like kind of make your, you know, add an air of creativity to it. And also kind of like, oh, well, the wing foils are designed this way to, because of this reason kind of thing. And then it also looks cool. So like,
also it's sick.
Yeah. So it's just like, I think that there was like just enough of a hint of like creativity mixed in with some of those design labs that we didn't really have like a critique per se. Like we did have like presentations and stuff, but that was still, you know, it just, we didn't have anything that was quite to that level. Like there was always like a, sometimes in like the design labs and stuff would have, there would be like a grading scale of like creativity, and it's like, cool. What exactly are you grading for that portion? So that's kind of like the confusing thing, but I appreciate that they had that in there, because I think that with some of the problems that they, you know, had us face, it does take a level of creativity in finding a new solution mm-hmm. and, you know, a creative and effective and efficient way to, you know, solve this problem. And so there's creativity in everything. And I think that some people also tend to forget that. Like one thing that's really interesting to see is I have, there's a few people from the Denver music scene that have gotten into coding and web design and stuff, where you get to do a lot of really cool, like basically coding graphic design. So basically using like lines of code to do these really cool designs and create these images and pictures and stuff mm-hmm. and just designing like a user interface. And that's super cool because it's like, you know, really exemplifying like there's creativity in every aspect of, you know, life and industry. It's mm-hmm. just the fact that certain industries actually value it and certain industries look down on it. But mm-hmm. if you look at anything, there's, you know, some kind of aspect of beauty to it. Like for me, like my, like I'm really into climbing and soccer for sports. And like, particularly I think with soccer, there's just like how people, you know, are able to, I almost want to say like manipulate the ball and just like use it, like their footwork, it can be super graceful and like creative mm-hmm. or like creating a play kind of thing. There's just like an aspect of like beauty to it. And same thing with like certain moves for climbing, like getting around a problem, you know, approaching it in a different way. There's like a level of creativity there. And I think that's what draws me to those sports in general. And, you know, that can be applied to engineering. It can be applied to coding. It can be applied to, I don't know how, but sales as well. Like you can find some way to inject creativity into any kind of industry. It's just a matter of whether or not you and society values that creativity, I think. Mm-hmm. I forgot what we were talking about. I think you guys asked me something and I totally, there was my tangent.
Well, I think it's a good tangent because it kind of brings us back to our original point where it's like, there's like art everywhere. Like mm-hmm. even in that example you were talking about, like sales, like finding mm-hmm. ways to make the sale is a creative problem. Like, how am I going to set up the display? How am I going to pitch this? Those are all creative things that like mm-hmm. take a level of like finesse, like really of like skilled labor, which I think kind of comes down to a lot of things, but.
There's no such thing as unskilled labor. Okay.
There really isn't.
Never thought about it that way.
Yeah. And I think that just society is, we've had periods where we get close to appreciating and valuing creativity to where it should be valued. But ultimately we always fall short and, you know, revert back to, and that's one thing that I was excited about the post-pandemic world. And mm-hmm. we're kind of, like, I'm still excited to see, I'm like half expecting like an explosion of art because people were locked in their houses to work on hobbies. And I'm excited to see what they did. Some of that's coming out, some of it isn't. And I just want to, you know, mm-hmm. I'm hoping for a more creative world fully on the other side of this whole pandemic. And I think in the back of my mind, I'm like expecting everyone to revert back to the, you know, not appreciating and fully valuing creativity in the world, unfortunately.
I kind of feel the same way. Like, I'm kind of afraid that's going to happen too, where people are going to stop in their own lives. They're going to stop like focusing on self-enriching activities like art or creating things, or just like doing something mentally stimulating other than work. Mm-hmm. And then they're just going to go back to their jobs and go back to eating out and go back to partying. And they're just going to forget everything that happened in their own homes. Mm-hmm. And I think when the pandemic first started and when lockdowns first started happening, every creative person just like exhaled at the same time. And everyone was just like, oh my God, finally, I can sit inside and do my work quietly and I can just be myself and no one is gonna like judge me for that. And I can literally just create and no one's gonna
really got that. Yeah.
Yeah. And like now that everything's opening back up again, I think that sense of unease is coming back because the world is just like going back to its like dark ways. It's evil, like corporate minded ways.
Yeah. And I think it also has something to do with like how you're talking about that book you read, The Cyborg.
Oh, The Cyborg Manifesto.
Yeah. Because I think that, you know, through the pandemic, the way that a lot of us kept in touch and shared our art and showed that like our quarantine projects was that online persona. And mm-hmm. I think that to an extent, a lot of people felt mm-hmm. more comfortable sharing themselves mm-hmm. online. They're more authentic selves online like that. And then now that we have to, you know, go back to in-person interactions and stuff, I think a lot of that, you know, self-fulfilling like freedom of online expression is kind of fading and we're getting back to, like you said, the unease of, well, now who's actually going to value what I did like in person? And I think that those self-esteem issues are going to start bubbling back up, unfortunately. But I think that it's not going to be complete. That's not going to be completely true across the board. But I do think it is going to be partly true for a lot of people. So hopefully we will make some progress there, but not as much as we'd hoped.
Yeah, there's like a level of sympathy that's leaving everyone's mind. This sort of camaraderie of like, oh, we're all like existing and like spending our time like the same way, but in different ways. And now we're just like back to the grind, you know? Mm-hmm. Oh, you're not going out. You're not seeing your friends. You're like being shut in, like, you know, the same sort of expectations of society are creeping on back. But like, I hope we're able to keep on this sort of idea of like, we can spend our time pursuing creative endeavors without caring about going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Or showing up to things, you know.
That's very important, like to just be able to be in the mindset of creating without necessarily having like this big giant goal at the end of the rainbow. I think if you're that kind of person that can just create and you just have the drive to just make things without necessarily wanting to do anything special with it, like wanting to show a bunch of people or get a million likes mm-hmm. or a million views or whatever, like if you can just be that kind of person that can simply make in silence and like you're the only one at the end of the day that ends up seeing it or truly appreciating it, I think that's what's going to make people successful artists, because it's really hard these days to do that. Or at least for me, it's really hard to do that, because I always like when I make art, I'm always like, oh, I need to share this online. Oh, I need to show this to this person. I can no longer be 100% like, oh, I'm going to make this and it's just going to be for me and for my enjoyment, simply because I wanted to make it and I had the desire to make it. Yeah. It's very hard to do that these days.
No, it so fucking is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like even like for me, I have like the like I'll sit in my room and just play music and it's just for me. And I think that that's my little corner. Like it doesn't have to be like performative. It's just me noodling around on guitar, or like playing a song just to like experience playing that song again because I love playing it kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I think that like whenever I write a song, it's hard to disconnect from like, oh, if I play this live, how's it going to go? How is it going to be received? If I record it, what am I going to add to it kind of thing?
Exactly. Like, are people going to like it? Are they going to hate me for this? Like, is this chord right? Does it sound right? I feel that.
Which is why I think it's so important to be able to have those moments where you can sit down and exist with your art and be okay when it's just you and your art, you know? Because if it, like, if you and your art can't exist in the same room quietly together, then I think you have some issues, you know? Right. Like, what, like, why is this important, you know? And it doesn't have to be, like, I mean, I guess it does get super deep, but, like, it's, I just think it's important for people to, like, not rely on interaction for things to be able to exist, you know?
Validation.
Yes.
External validation.
Be your own validation, yes.
Right. Yeah, it's, I don't know why, like, a lot of beautiful and talented artists are, like, just basically, like, whoring themselves out, for lack of a better word, just for likes. And you can tell, like, I always believe that you can tell the difference between, like, a piece of art or a song or a sculpture or a performance that was made out of the pure desire to make it and nothing else versus a piece that was, like, clearly made for the audience to like, absorb media, I guess. Like, you can always tell the difference just by looking at something. Like, what was the artist's intention, if they had any?
No, so I've definitely, yeah. I've seen that sort of since I've, like, embarked back onto Instagram, like, scrolling and seeing people, like, I'm like, you're just churning these out with the same sort of, like, intention of, like, interaction for, like, I mean, I guess, like, how do you judge something that's authentic when you don't know what's going on? But I don't know. It's just, like, feelings you get, you know, and it's just sort of, it's a weird disconnect that I feel like people can sense sometimes. And I mean, I guess sometimes, like, even I make artwork that I'm like, okay, I'm going to create this cute little painting and I'm going to record it and it's going to be like fine to interact with because you can see me creating this process, which I know people really like, and I'm going to use these colors and, like, whatever. Yeah. But it's still like, I'm still hanging that little painting up for me, you know, like, I'm not painting like, oh, everyone loves seeing, like, these flowers, like, right now. I'm going to paint these flowers and, like, be on the hype, like, you know?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think even though I used to struggle with that, I guess this idea of external validation from others in terms of my art, I think in these past couple of years, I think I've been slowly understanding that that doesn't have to be a crutch and it doesn't necessarily enrich anyone's art. It's just a dopamine hit at the end of the day.
Yeah, get that serotonin.
Yeah, it's literally just a sip of serotonin from the serotonin juice box. But on my Instagram page, I've been less concerned about, like, how the feed flows and more concerned with just, like, we were talking at the beginning of the podcast, documenting my creativity process. Because these last couple of posts I did are very, I want to say, chaotic. And it's moving away from, like, my Y2K style, and it's starting to go into the territory of very abstract. Because personally, the biggest thing that I've always been struggling with in terms of my art process is the detail level. I can literally spend a week on, like, one corner of a painting, and I still won't be fucking happy with it. And that just slows me down, man. Like, in a perfect world, I'd be doing, like, at least one painting a day, which is not the standard. It's not, like, the golden standard by anyone's means. But for me personally, if I could just make, like, one painting a day, that'd be, like, the definition of success to me. So I was like, what can I change in my process that will, like, help me accomplish that? I just had to let go of the concept of detail and tediousness, like tedious brush strokes, tedious, like finding a color palette that matches. Like, that absorbs so much of my time. I'm just a slow person when it comes to that kind of stuff. So I had to let go of that personally. And with these past couple of posts on my Instagram, which is I'm going to plug myself right now.
Yes.
Yes.
My Instagram is at Rudy, R-U-D-I dot J-I-E dot A dot F-A. Rudy Giaffa. That's my Instagram. Please give it a look.
Go follow her. She's awesome.
Thank you. In my recent, I guess, two or three posts, they've been splatter paintings, which kind of like it's anti-detailed because I'm just throwing paint at the canvas. I'm literally just throwing it and splashing it, and it's just a giant tantrum. And then I just, on top of the splatters, I'm painting these squiggly blob shapes that kind of depict a sense of emotional motion, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like the last one I painted was a gray blob, and I was feeling very confused at the time. So it's a gray blob with like some knots in it, just to depict a confused mind with brain fog. That's what I've been doing recently, and it's very freeing because I don't have to worry about, does this blob look representational or not? Is it representational to a real blob? Because a blob doesn't really exist in real life. But I just went on a giant tangent for the 500th time, and I'm so sorry about that.
Podcast baby.
Don't apologize. That's why we're here.
Thank you.
Well, and I love you talking about that because I love that you're letting loose and expressing yourself in a way that isn't tied to rendering, which is something that I think a lot of artists can get tied down to, is like, okay, now I need to polish this concept versus just, I need to just let loose, you know, and express myself on canvas, on paper, on whatever, and just like see how I feel and try and express that instead of creating a beautifully polished, detailed, rendered illustration, you know, which is always nice to be able to do, but it must be
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go on.
I'm kind of envious that you're having this sort of experience of like expressive sort of impressionistic vibey art, you know, just like going ham on a canvas and having your little splatter tantrums and just like being able to do that. That sounds awesome. I might experiment a little bit with that.
Please do that. I mean, I love your dragons and I think you're excellent at what you do. Your colors and your line work are always a pleasure to look at, but I'd be super into it if I could see like the crazy artistic splatter paint Beth. That'd be sick to look at, honestly, because it's like completely opposite of what you do now, which are these beautiful, giant, beautiful winged dragons.
I love you. We'll fuck around. We got the summer.
Yes. Yeah, man, just do it, honestly. And Patrick, you should start splattering sound onto your next song. Like, just splatter whatever that means to you.
Just have some kind of like interesting dissonant like background sound.
Yeah, like Mars.
Yes. Yes.
Honestly. That'd be sick.
Just make weird sounds. I've been thinking about that actually, because I've been you know, just kind of like, how can I get the most unique kind of sound? Because I think that like my biggest thing is just overthinking recording. And so that's been like my biggest you know, thing to overcome when I like record, is like, oh, I need to have someone who actually knows what they're doing. And then I hear stories about like Led Zeppelin, what was it, when the Levee breaks, how the drums were recorded for that was they just had like one mic. And I think they either carried the drum set like up this like spiral, like iron staircase, and then they just put the mic at the bottom and like recorded it that way.
Interesting.
I'm just like, the fuck, I should just do weird shit like that. Like, why not try something kind of goofy dumb like that and just see how it turns out?
Something creative, something out of the box.
Honestly, I think what usually happens to people, like in the most roundabout way, is that their least precious work or their least precious novel or their least precious song is the one that just makes it super, super big. Like, have you guys heard the story of like Seal's song, Kiss from a Rose?
Not really, no. I know the song.
You know the song? Beth, do you know that song?
I mean, probably. I don't, like, you know.
Am I allowed to sing that, or are you guys going to get sued?
I don't know.
I have no idea.
Can I sing it for you, and then you edit it out if you're afraid of getting sued?
Sure, yeah.
Sure, yeah. Let's roll.
It's like, baby, I compare you to a kiss from a rose.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, that song, Seal had it in a tape deck in his apartment for years, and no one knew about it, and he was afraid of releasing it. But then his friend found it. He was like, Seal, what is this? Can I listen to it? And Seal's like, oh, that's just my old song. I really hate it. I don't like it at all. Just, I mean, I guess you can play it, but it's trash. It's disgusting. Then the friend played it, and he was like, Seal, what the fuck? Do you understand what this song is? And Seal's like, no, it's trash. It's garbage. Like, please stop. Don't play it again. And then it turned out to be like Seal's number one hit. And like people are playing it in weddings. It was in the Batman movie. Like what? And then like also Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Like she thought that was gonna be shit. But then that was like her biggest selling book ever. I just think those little like projects where you're just fucking around and not being serious at all, those are the ones that people like somehow ended up being attracted and interested in them.
I mean, I think to that extent, they're the most authentic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Take a risk on your art.
Yes, risk. It's all about the risk.
The risk is the sharing, but you just gotta do it.
Mm-hmm. That's the hardest part.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rudy, I love you and I love talking to you, and I could hang out with you all day and just talk about art and nonsense and stuff, but we're kind of getting to that time. So are you just on Instagram?
Right now I'm just on Instagram. I actually have two Instagram accounts, but I forgot the name of the second one, but it's in my bio in my first Instagram account, which is rudi.jie.a.fa. I'm plugging it again.
Yes.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, that's just like, I'm just on Instagram right now. And I have a website, and that's also in my bio, which I really need to update my website. Thank you for reminding me of that.
That's just life of having a website. Oh yeah, I haven't updated that since 2013.
Yeah. It's been 12 years. I forgot.
All right, but we do have one more question for you.
Yes, of course.
Patty?
So we've been asking everybody this, but Rudy, what feels like home to you?
I think home is not a physical place, but a mindset that you can return to at the end of the day. And I think home for me is definitely the moment where I'm just sitting down and drawing. When the pencil touches the paper, or when the paintbrush touches a canvas, and I can just like let go of anything that I've been thinking about and just look at what's in front of me, that's home to me, because I don't have to worry about anything. I'm just here in the moment. That's home to me.
Hell yeah. I love that. Going into that meditative state of making art, coming home.
Yeah, that's literally home for, I think, a lot of artists.
Hmm.
That's my answer for you.
Spent the last year trying to mend the way you left me lying wide out in my bed.
Yeah, this has been awesome.
Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Healed by Lore, since we literally didn't mention.
Oh, right. Hi.
Man, just got too involved in the conversation. It happens.
It does.
There's something precious in its design.
You guys are excellent interviewers, and it just felt natural the entire time to talk with both of you.
I'm glad. We're just three bros with a mic.
Just three bros and some mics.
Three bros, one with some mics.
Hell yeah. That's what I wanted.